Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Emma Wallace in Bonn. On today's programme, as banks reopen in Cyprus, how are people feeling?
We heard last night about family with five children, both employees at Laiki. They're going to lose their jobs and they don't know about whether they're getting the Providence Fund or not. So they're waiting. It's this uncertainty. I mean, it just destroys your psychology.
Also on Inside Europe, it's all about money today. Confused about the terms of the bailout? We'll shed some light on it. We'll also be looking into how German Kurds helped to fund the PKK in Turkey and the Spanish town hoping to tax the church to stay afloat. Those stories and more coming up on the programme. We start this week's programme once again back in Cyprus after it became the first ever EU country to impose capital controls as its banks finally reopened on Thursday. For the people of the island, these past few weeks have been an emotional rollercoaster. With the threat of mass unemployment looming, feelings are running high. Nathan Morley in Nicosia has been finding out how people are coping.
We'll have to go through some tough times and will suffer the consequences of a protracted period.
The Finance Minister, Michalis Saris, is back on television again. And this time he's saying that new strict capital controls are necessary to restore confidence in the banking system. The long-suffering public here, though, are not convinced. According to the decree, the maximum amount of cash withdrawals cannot exceed €300 a day per person. The cashing of cheques is no longer allowed. That's a bizarre move, according to Kostas, a local shopkeeper in the tourist resort of Ayia Napa. He tells me that most of his business, like thousands of others, functions on paying suppliers with cheques.
The biggest problem, we can't work with cheques, you know. We have to pay everything cash, and people have no money to shop, you know. That's a bigger problem with the bank. We're running out because we have to buy more than the money we receive.
And across the street, it's the same story at the petrol station.
We need the cash to pay for our people. They working here, somebody who's applied for us something. We have to pay in cash. So we take only cash now.
So Cyprus is the first EU country to bring in capital controls. It's just the latest twist in this seemingly never-ending saga. Since this crisis began, just about everybody in Cyprus has been glued to television news broadcasts, which have been playing out like a soap opera. Tragedy, suspense, despair, hope, and of course the daily cliffhanger. What will we wake up to tomorrow? Kostandinos Zindas has been the very public face of this crisis on the main state television channel. He says the volume of news and some of the stories arriving on his desk are heartbreaking.
There's a lot of cases coming out now, particularly bank employees with Laiki. I mean, we heard last night about family with five children, both employees at Laiki. They're going to lose their jobs and they don't know about whether they're getting the Providence Fund or not. So they're waiting. It's this uncertainty. I mean, it just destroys your psychology. It's not just about what's going to happen. I mean, you don't know what's going to happen. It's just so uncertain at the moment.
Demonstrations have become a daily event on the streets of Nicosia. The public are jittery, they're fed up, and every hour brings more anxiety and harsher words. People are looking for somebody to blame. They ask, how did Cyprus get into this mess?
We know that this is only the beginning, actually. The government is obliged and has undertaken to proceed to privatization of semi-government organizations, which obviously will lead to a steep increase of unemployment.
The European Union is governed by dictators in Brussels. People have to wake up. The European Union has not been established for the benefit of the people. The European Union has been established for the benefit of the banks and the big corporations. If people don't understand this and work against it, slavery is very close for all of us in the European Union.
As the impact of this economic crisis deepens and becomes more widespread, more and more individuals and families are displaying the signs of emotional strain. Kostandinos Sindas again.
And it will take a long time to actually settle to this new reality. From one day to the next, literally, everything changed. So it might take a week, it might take 2 weeks, it might take a month. I think it will take quite a while for people to sort of engage themselves in this kind of conversation with people around them and see what's actually going on and really find some closure. I don't know.
The president, Nikos Anastasiades, has only been in the job 3 weeks. His baptism of fire appears to be never-ending, but his leadership has not been questioned, and optimism has become his watchword.
We look with optimism into the future. There is a new day for Cyprus tomorrow.
Nathan Morley, DW, Nicosia.
Well, it's not just the people of Cyprus who are confused. Events there are being watched closely right across the EU and the world, not least after the threat to levy spot taxes from everyone's savings. After the deal was brokered, more jargon about so-called good banks, bad banks, capital controls, haircuts and levies floated around. Cyprus is the fifth country in the Eurozone to receive a bailout, so does anyone really know what they're doing in Brussels? And will this latest bailout work, or could we, as some doom-mongers suggest, be facing the end of the euro as we know it? Waltraud Schelkler is a senior lecturer in political economy at the London School of Economics, and she joined me on the line to try and bring some clarity to the situation.
I don't see that the euro has to fail. In a way, I think the Cyprus deal was a good deal. It has to be phased in at some point that not every depositor can be saved. And an issue that is quite independent of the euro crisis, namely that small countries that cannot quite decide whether they want to be countries or a bank, have to understand that if they free ride on others' tax base, then they cannot expect that they will be completely and 100% bailed out.
Part of the deal is one bank is essentially going to be closed down. And there's always this talk when bailout deals like this are proposed of good banks and bad banks, good companies and bad assets, and splitting them. Is that just another way of saying that they are bailing out bits of the bank and writing off the debts, or giving a haircut, as they like to say, to the other half? Or is that actually a different process?
The split between a good bank and a bad bank tries to save the viable portions of a bank. You win basically time to do an orderly insolvency.
Okay. Do you think that fears in Europe, in the rest of Europe, have been calmed? Now they're not going after small investors and they're not taking a one-off levy from people's savings?
I think the fears that they may not go after small savers cannot be completely calmed down anymore. I mean, I'm afraid the genie is out of the bottle there, and that is the lasting problem of how this was done last week. I don't want to sound too positive, you know, because at the moment there's very little you can see as positive and bright in this euro crisis management. But in a way, savers must also be aware that if banks pay interest rates or give you conditions for credit that are so out of line with what everybody else offers, that it is also your own responsibility not to go into such banks, because they are unlikely to have a business model that is replicable. And it's not everybody else's responsibility then to bail you out. In that sense, perhaps there is some little small silver lining in this decision.
On that point, the German media in particular, but I think everyone has this kind of Robin Hood attitude that it's quite good to go after the big investors. And if these people have been getting away with tax haven status for a while, then why shouldn't they bail themselves out rather than asking for money from Brussels or from German banks? But do you think that it's actually realistic to go after big investors? Won't they have already got their money out?
Yes, the big investors are unlikely to have not spotted what is going to happen. And it is usually, and I'm afraid that such cases do exist, that, say, the employees of Laiki Bank themselves have pension assets in the bank or big deposits. And if the government doesn't decide to take some of these 10 billion to compensate them for it, I'm afraid they will also be hurt by it. And it's obvious that these are not the ones we wanted to hurt with it. But this is just a side effect. I mean, that is what happens in a country crisis.
On the political aspect of all this, how divided was the Eurozone on the bailout? Has there been a bigger divide after the Cypriot crisis?
There seems to be a divide now between the IMF and the European Commission. The Commission is obviously concerned about the whole fallout from these rather harsh programs that these countries have to undergo, who basically have to do this real devaluation that is forcing down prices and wages in the country because they can't do anything else. In a way, I'm glad that they do not completely close ranks, because there are legitimate these debates. To what extent should you favor a realistic and quick and technocratically clean resolution of banks and so on, or to what extent you have to go a bit more slowly and make concessions, and that the Commission tries to play a little bit this role of a broker between the two, I think is not a bad thing. We need to find a way of making us being able to live with diversity, just as one does in every insurance scheme. I want to go together with risks that are not exactly my risks, and then we benefit from insuring each other. And this is what the EU is about. It doesn't require a permanent transfer union, but it needs a few mechanisms that makes it possible for middle-income countries that want to catch up quickly to adjust.
That was Waltraud Schelkler in London, and I'm Emma Wallace in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. Abdullah Öcalan, the jailed leader of the PKK, might have just announced a ceasefire with the Turkish government in time for Kurdish New Year, but after three decades of war, peace is still in its infancy. The Kurdish group has been waging a war for more rights for the Kurdish minority in Turkey. In Europe, the PKK has been listed as a terrorist organization following attacks on Turkish shops and institutions in the 1990s. But funding and contributions for the organization's political and military wing still pour in, much of it from Germany's 800,000 Kurds, who hope that with a ceasefire, the organization might be taken off the terrorist list. Naomi Conrad reports from Berlin.
A man in a greasy red apron is enthusiastically chopping tomatoes as two meat skewers sizzle away on the grill. Above his head, a huge faded poster of impossibly lush mountains somewhere in Anatolia welcomes the steady trickle of customers dodging the remorselessly icy wind blowing down the alleyway outside. This is one of Berlin's many Turkish cafes, and the meeting place Ismail has chosen for a chat about the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party that launched a guerrilla war against the Turkish state in the early 1980s. Its aim was an independent nation-state, in response to a policy of forced and sometimes brutal assimilation.
When I was young, we were beaten at school for speaking Kurdish.
Ismail's teachers managed to beat the Kurdish language out of him. Today, he speaks Turkish at home. He shrugs, then readjusts his brown corduroy coat. He moved to Berlin in the 1970s. At university, he met some young Kurdish activists. Ever since, he has been fighting for the cause by organizing rallies, cultural events and roundtable discussions on Kurdish rights.
Let's say I'm a Kurdish politician, nothing else.
Ismail leans forward emphatically. No, he is not a member of the PKK, the organization as he calls it. That would be a legal offense. In the 1990s, the civil war between the PKK and the Turkish military escalated and reached Germany. Amidst a wave of attacks on Turkish travel agencies, corner shops and pubs, the German government outlawed the PKK as a terrorist organization. Suspected members faced prosecution, and jail.
Yes, back then there were a couple of attacks. Not all of that was okay, but people were angry. I mean, people who lost their children, brothers or their father, you couldn't just tell them, just keep calm.
The ban did little to dent the PKK's popularity among the Kurdish diaspora. The German government estimates that out of a community of 800,000 Kurds, some 13,000 actively support the PKK.
Of course, some young European and German Kurds have joined the guerrilla groups in Turkey. That's normal. You can't prevent it.
Again, Ismail shrugs. When he was young, there were no guerrilla camps hidden away high up in the Turkish mountains. Otherwise, who knows, maybe he would have made his way up to the mountains, he says softly, leaning forward. But, he quickly adds, the PKK doesn't actively recruit European Kurds for their war. It's their money it's after. Off the record, European officials say several millions of euros are donated each year to support the PKK's European operations, which include TV channels and annual cultural events that draw thousands. In the past, there have been accusations of extortion and money laundering. According to a written statement by Berlin's police spokesman, that has become rare.
In the last couple of years, there have been very few legal investigations concerning the possible extortion of funds by the PKK. In Berlin, the last such investigation was conducted in 2008.
For the PKK has changed tactics in Europe, preferring to portray itself as a pacifist organisation.
After the events of the 1990s, the PKK hierarchy, as well as its leader, Abdullah Öcalan, very clearly prohibited any violence in Europe, including protests and demonstrations.
Muzaffer Yato is one of the PKK's founding members who spent more than two decades locked away in Turkish jails. Today, he's been granted conditional asylum in Germany. He is unable to leave the southern city of Stuttgart or engage in politics. Yet he maintains contact with high-ranking PKK officials, he says.
Will there be more violent attacks by the PKK in Germany or Europe? No, most emphatically not.
The PKK, Ayata stresses, has changed. It has given up its demand for a Kurdish state and instead calls for Kurdish rights within a democratic Turkish state. It has also dropped its Marxist-Leninist propaganda. Ongoing talks between the PKK and the Turkish government resulted in PKK leader Abdullah Öcalan announcing a ceasefire in late March. Should the two sides really reach a lasting compromise, it may be time for the West to reconsider its ban, Gulben Gürbey from Berlin University says.
In that case, the West would have to reconsider the ban depending on developments.
German officials are sceptical. They point to prior ceasefires that were broken, negotiations that unraveled. Germany will only reconsider its ban, they say, if the PKK's fighters fully disarm. Back in the cafe, Ismail too remains cautious. He doesn't trust the Turkish government and points to Syria, where a branch of the PKK is fighting in the Kurdish north.
If we're attacked again, we need to be able to defend ourselves.
The fight, he says, will only end once Kurds and Turks have equal rights. Outside, bracing Berlin's icy wind, he starts talking about his grandson, whose father is Turkish. Perhaps he sees in his grandson a tentative hope for a new future. For DW, this is Naomi Conrad in Berlin.
And talking of funding, as the financial crisis continues to rage across Europe, bankrupt municipalities are looking for new sources of revenue, and some are eyeing up the Catholic Church as the proverbial cash cow. In Spain, the church is the country's largest and richest landowner, but its non-profit status means it's exempt from paying most taxes. Lauren Freya visited a college town near Madrid that's struggling to serve the local church an up-to-date property tax bill.
Off a cobblestone street in Alcalá de Henares, an ancient Roman town about 30 kilometres from Madrid, there's a 400-year-old convent, El Convento de Clarisas de San Diego. If you ring the doorbell, one of the nuns calls out from behind a wooden shutter. Then you place your order. In addition to prayer and charity, the nuns here run a side business selling candied almonds from this tiny window in their convent. The nuns' profits from their almond enterprise are probably meager, But that's beside the point, say some local lawmakers. The nuns are using at least part of this convent for commercial purposes, and for that they must pay.
Pues lo que planteábamos es que se debía hacer un estudio.
What we're studying is whether any church properties that have been listed for a long time as charities are actually being used for commercial activities. If that's the case, they'll have to start paying taxes.
City Councilman Anselmo Avendano passed a motion last summer to reevaluate church holdings by square footage. So if one out of 30 rooms in a convent is selling suites, it'll have to pay tax on that one room. That's how the system is supposed to work already, but it's not always enforced. Alcalá's campaign has ruffled feathers on high. Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy told reporters last year that any efforts to press the church for more tax violate a 1979 treaty with the Vatican. Councilman Avendano says he's a Catholic himself.
We're not questioning the church's good works. What we want is to re-examine property the church uses to make a profit. For example, rental apartments, parking lots, and garages that it owns. Those are businesses.
The Catholic Church owns about half of this city. Sometimes people die and leave their house or business to the church, which then becomes a landlord. Another councilman, Ricardo Rubio, takes me on a walking tour of church holdings in town.
Some of the Catholic schools have swimming pools, and they charge a fee to area residents to swim there on weekends. So the school should be paying tax on that activity, but they haven't been.
Incidentally, we're walking down Calle Tercio, 1/3 Street. The name dates back to the Middle Ages when vendors here were required to give 1/3 of their profits to the Catholic Church. Nowadays, there's a different tax man in town who happens to be broke. The city of Alcalá de Henares is more than 300 million euros in debt. Meanwhile, if the Catholic Church had to pay tax on all of its property in Spain, it could owe up to 3 billion euros a year. Juanjo Pico is a spokesman for Europa Laica, a Spanish group that lobbies for the separation of church and state.
En esta época de crisis económica,
these days, towns are cutting their budgets for healthcare, education, infrastructure and welfare. But the Catholic Church hasn't had to make a single cut because it gets money from the state.
When Spaniards file their tax returns, they can check a box to donate money to the church, and the state deducts it automatically. That's coming under scrutiny as Spain becomes increasingly secular. For their part, Catholic Church officials question why this seems to be only about them.
Why isn't this debate about all non-profit groups?
Fernando Jiménez Barrio Canal is the financial director at Spain's Council of Bishops. He says the church has the same tax deal as the Red Cross and other NGOs. He also hints at what could happen if the Catholic Church were to have to pay more.
Evidentemente tendría que destinar dinero para pagar esos impuestos.
Obviously, we'd have to direct more of our money to pay those taxes. The church would still want to help those in need, but we'd have less money to do that.
The church may be Spain's biggest landowner, but it's also the biggest charity here. At a time when public welfare programs are being cut and unemployment tops 26%. The Alcalá Town Council aims to complete its land survey by the end of the year and possibly serve the Catholic Church with a slightly updated tax bill. Lauren Freyer, DW, Alcalá de Henares, Spain.
Don't forget to drop us a line if you have a comment or query on the programme. Our email address is europe@dw.de. Or put pen to paper, add a stamp and address the envelope Inside Europe, the European Desk, Deutsche Welle, Bonn, Germany. We would love to hear from you. This is Inside Europe and I'm Emma Wallace in Bonn. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Emma Wallace in Bonn. Over the next half hour, would you fancy sleeping in a hotel without a roof?
-5 degrees, and I'm taking off my shoes.
-5 degrees?
Yeah, and I'm taking off my shoes.
Also on Inside Europe, we'll meet the man who became an expert on Syrian weapons from his kitchen in the UK. And just across the water, the campaign to get Belfast back on its feet after protests made the city go quiet. Much louder sounds in Paris, where new bells will ring in Easter in Notre Dame. And more music in Germany, as a jubilee gears up in praise of Luther. Those stories and more coming up on the programme. A charity campaigning on behalf of homeless people has started up an unusual hotel where guests get the chance to sleep rough. The idea is to increase sympathy and awareness of the plight of the homeless. It costs $10 a night to rent each so-called room in Gothenburg, Western Sweden, from where Malcolm Brabant reports.
Okay, vi ska vi säga på svenska då?
Ja, vi pratar
ju normalt. Ja, vi kommer gå då upp dit då, som sagt. Ja.
Anna Elverston, a 40-year-old unemployed care worker, is heading for a hotel room with no roof in a district called King's Heights. She's accompanied by a homeless man, José Georges Blanchiot, who's guiding Anna to her bed. There's no snow on the ground, but it's freezing.
I've decided to do this to get an insight into how the homeless people and the weak people in the society lives. You have to look after the vulnerable. It's the main key in having a society that is strong and that is compassionate about their people living in their country.
Her companion for the evening, José, is remarkably upbeat about his existence.
Don't look down on me. Don't feel sorry for me, because I am myself to blame on this situation. It's nobody else's fault that I'm homeless. So don't feel sorry, but give me respect as a human. That's the toughest thing, wherever you are, to get accepted as a human being. -5 degrees, and I'm taking off my shoes.
-5 degrees?
Yeah, and I'm taking off my shoes.
José has been living on the streets for years after succumbing to drug addiction following the suicide of his wife. He's acting as Anna's protector as she prepares for a night beneath the stars. The man behind the idea is Aaron Israelson, the editor of a homeless magazine called Factum. He leads me to another place favoured by down and outs. By chance, he meets an unlucky former businessman who wants to remain anonymous.
So, have you been homeless for quite some time? Or?
Yes, because I have a concussion. Yeah.
He says he ended up sleeping under a bush after becoming bankrupt. Sweden is the third most prosperous nation in the world. It has a tremendous welfare system, which makes it all the more surprising that so many people are falling through the safety net. According to Aaron Israelson, there are 34,000 homeless people in Sweden, and 10% of them are here in Gothenburg.
Homelessness is getting worse in Sweden, and one of the worst aspects is that women, often with kids, are getting homeless, and that is a poverty-related homelessness, strictly poverty-related, in contrast to the traditional groups of homeless people who often have drug abuse problems or drinking problems.
Back at the hill, with the wall shielding them from the wind, Anna and José are tucked up in sleeping bags efficient to -15 degrees Celsius.
I'm not freezing at the least, so as it is right now, I'm quite comfortable.
They're in good spirits as they settle down at 9 p.m. But 5 hours later, the wind changes direction, blasts them head on, the temperature drops, and they give up. Later that day, Anna and I meet up for coffee at Gothenburg Station, another magnet for the homeless. Not far from the cafe, a Romanian busker is tapping out tunes on a unique stringed instrument, and a middle-aged Roma woman is sitting on the ground begging. Despite failing to make it through the night, Anna learned some important lessons.
Unless you're actually in the situation where you have to do something, you have to survive, then you can't understand. It's true that saying they say you have to walk a mile in someone else's shoe before you can fully understand them.
Anna now plans to give hotel reservations to Swedish politicians, challenging them to experience the lives of the country's most impoverished citizens. Malcolm Brabant, DW, Gothenburg, Sweden.
The Syrian conflict might be happening a little outside Europe's borders, but that doesn't mean that it's not an important theme for the EU. Just this week, the Syrian opposition have been stepping up efforts to win Western and international support, for example, by asking Britain and France to make good on promises to supply weapons to the Free Syrian Army. Well, one European who has been watching even more closely than most is a blogger called Brown Moses, a.k.a. Elliot Higgins. He's been following the conflict from his kitchen in Leicester in the British Midlands and has become so expert in spotting weapons and analysing videos from the conflict that he's been helping journalists and human rights organisations and has even broken a few stories of his own. He joined me from Leicester to explain how it all started.
The reason I started the blog, it was really out of my own interest in conflicts going on in relation to the Arab Spring. I followed Libya extremely closely, and it was quite interesting to see how, you know, again, through social media, you could get little bits of extra information what was going on in the conflict, especially from journalists tweeting from Libya. And when it came to Syria, I thought there's so much information that was missed in Libya. Why not put that in one place for myself and for other people as well?
Was it quite difficult then, when you're looking at all these videos in a language that presumably you don't speak, to really understand, A, what's going on, and B, what is correct information?
Well, one of the reasons I sort of focus on arms is because they're quite easy to sort of spot and identify. You don't really need to know the language, and they're actually quite straightforward, so they aren't very time-consuming to work on. But I do look at other areas. I've examined a couple of war crimes before. What I've done with one example, there was an execution in Aleppo of 20 soldiers, and I found the original Facebook page it was posted on, and that belonged to a group, and they had posted it on their own YouTube channel. So I knew that was a sort of genuine video because they had been using that channel for a long time. So to me, that seemed like pretty good evidence it belonged to that group. But it's really using the resources available to make as much of these videos as possible.
You make it sound, A, very easy, and what you do not very complicated, but in fact it's incredibly specialised what you do.
I think because I've been doing it for quite a while, I mean, it's like with Syria, I've been covering, watching videos from there for about a year, and I've been very careful to analyse the videos in it. So now, when I see a video coming from Syria, I immediately spot anything that's going to be interesting very, very quickly.
You're now working with lots of journalists. You've been working on articles with New York Times journalists and NGOs. Do you see yourself and the work you're doing as journalism?
You know, it's almost like recording a history of the conflict, the sort of areas that are being missed by the traditional media. But I've never really seen myself as a journalist.
So what does a typical day involve for you?
In the evening, I'll sit down with my laptop and start working my way through all the videos that have been posted on YouTube channels. I've actually collected about a list of 450 YouTube channels I try and check on a regular basis. Then I keep an eye out for anything interesting that in those channels and then see if there's anything worth blogging about.
And when you do blog and you post these things on your blog, you've actually broken stories, haven't you? Like the start of the use of cluster bombs in Syria, and also now recently an alleged Croatian arms trade going on.
Well, the cluster bomb story, in a way, it was quite straightforward because I was just searching through videos as normal, and I came across a video that showed what looked to me at the time, I wasn't even familiar with cluster bombs at the time, but it looked to me what could be like cluster bombs. So I started looking through various reference images and managed to find the exact type of cluster bomb it was and lots of additional information. So I put the blog post up, and then Human Rights Watch picked up on that story, and that was the first use. And that was back in July. And then later on in October, the government forces started using massive amounts of cluster bombs. And at that point, I started tracking all of them. And now I'm working with Human Rights Watch to collect all the videos of cluster bombs used in Syria. So far, I've got around 500 videos collected, sorted by regions. And the information is going to be put out into the public eventually, and it'll be used for various products, such as finding where these bombs are so they can be removed. With the Croatian weapons, that was a bit more complex because that was really a case of seeing individual examples of weapons that I didn't think belonged in Syria. First of all, it was rocket launchers from Yugoslavia. And then M60 recoilless guns from Yugoslavia, and they aren't used by the Syrian army, so they were very strange, but I thought it could be, you know, just some black market arms. But then a video was posted on state television that showed hundreds of rounds of ammunition for these weapons and four different types of weapons, all that had links to Croatia, because there was also a RBG6 grenade launcher, which was manufactured in Croatia, and RPG-22 rocket launchers, which are Soviet but also used in Croatia. So there was a certain amount of linkage between all of them. So when I was asked to write a blog for the New York Times on a subject, I picked that subject, and they were very impressed by what I wrote and decided to take it further.
So then they started investigating it, and the journalist that worked with you has sort of confirmed that there is this arms trade going on?
That's right. They had several journalists working on it, and they did a massive amount of work to confirm this with various sources. They've pretty much mapped out the whole thing. They've done a really tremendous job, and they've shown that the Croatians were selling arms to the Saudi Arabians, who have then flying them to Jordan to be smuggled over to the border into Syria.
And when you say Croatians, do you mean Croatian government, Croatian arms companies, or just Croatians?
As far as I'm aware, it's an official project. I'm not sure who's exactly is aware of it, but it's certainly it's not something that's being done by sort of criminals or the black market. It's, you know, it's got official rubber snap stamp as far as I'm aware, but the question is who actually knows about it, because it's interesting that the MP Tom Watson in the UK has been asking the British government what they were aware of with the whistle project, and so far they've been unable to answer his questions.
Have you got any desire to go to Syria now and verify things for yourself on the ground?
I'd love to sort of be there and looking at the sort of stuff, you know, on the videos. I mean, sometimes you want to see what the serial numbers are on guns and, you know, for the real arms tracking. But I'm constantly told by journalists in the area how bad the situation is out there on the ground for anyone who's coming in to investigate, just for the sheer level of violence and journalists being targeted. And you hear about all these sort of amateur journalists who, you know, they might be in a gap year or they think they've got a camera, so they qualify as a journalist, going over there, getting themselves in trouble. And I just think there's enough serious people out there, serious journalists and serious investigators, that they don't need a blogger from England popping over to join in.
Elliot Higgins, a.k.a. Brown Moses, talking to me from Leicester in the UK. And from one armed conflict to another, the so-called Troubles may be mostly gone in the Northern Irish capital Belfast, but scars still remain. So when flag protests and violence started up at the end of last year over how many days the City Hall should fly the Union Jack flag, memories of the sectarian violence of decades past quickly resurfaced. Not surprisingly, the violence had an impact on local businesses, with restaurants, shops and even the city's many pubs staying empty. But local merchants have decided to take matters into their own hands to change that, with a campaign inspired by the efforts to regenerate post-9/11 New York. Anya Cooper's stopped off in Belfast to find out more.
The Morning Star pub, tucked away in one of Belfast's tiny side alleys, or entries as they're known locally, is the city's second oldest pub. It dates back to 1810, and downstairs at the original and still shiny mahogany bar, you'll find a colourful array of Guinness lovers at any time of day, enjoying a pint of the black stuff. But even this old favourite has been through a tough few months.
It was scary. Coming into work, especially in the afternoon, there was nobody about.
Seamus O'Hara is the manager of the Morning Star pub, and he says profits were down about 40% over Christmas alone due to the flag protests.
It was felt badly here, yes, especially coming up to Christmas. We had a lot of bookings that were cancelled due to the protests. People were scared to come in, so they cancelled all their bookings.
The flag protests that flared up before Christmas and through January tarnished the image of the lively and thoroughly modern Belfast of today, bustling with shoppers and tourists. Some hardened locals, out on a windy day in Belfast, didn't take it too seriously.
I grew up during the main Troubles, love. That's kids playing in a park.
But others were genuinely scared.
First night of the protest, we were up the road there, and it was scary, because there were so many protesters. You know.
And some, like longtime Belfast newspaper vendor Billy McDonnell, predicted the worst.
You have a marching season coming up, so that could be the start of it again, unless it gets something sorted, you know. Hopefully it doesn't go back to where it was, but it could do if it keeps on the way it is.
Northern Ireland's marching season, parades mostly organised by Protestant or Unionist groups, begins at Easter. It used to lead to violence, but has passed peacefully in recent years. And this peace made space for the huge commercial success of 2012. But then Christmas and January were an economic low point. Confederation of British Industry figures show businesses lost up to £15 million because of the protests.
There was a sense of frustration, not just for me, but for everybody in the business world, because nobody knew what to do. How do we fix this? How do we address it?
Stephen McGorian is the managing director of a chain of restaurants, hotels and bars and chairman of the Belfast Visitor and Convention Bureau. He knew something had to change, and so he started a campaign the likes of which had only ever been seen once before in New York post 9/11. It was supposed to get people back onto the streets, not protesting, but spending money by shopping, eating and drinking.
So what we needed to do was change the conversation, get the word out that this is not as bad as it is being portrayed. And the only way to do that was to appeal to the hearts and minds of Belfast citizens. And that's what Back in Belfast was about. It was a call to arms. It was a call to local citizens of Belfast to say, the image of your city has been tarnished in the international world. Are you going to sit at home and complain about it? Or are you going to vote with your feet and get back into the city?
The Back in Belfast campaign was brought to life by Fiona Ure and her colleagues at the Belfast Visitor and Convention Bureau. She says the effects of the protests, which spread quickly by social media, were undeniably damaging. But the campaign has quickly proven itself a success.
The Irish, whether north or south, are renowned for their humour, and I think that's always helped. They're a social bunch, so generally people are quite social, want to go out, meet up with friends, go out for dinner. So it's just reminding them that's exactly what it's all about.
That's our buffet menu. That's what we have on today. And that's our a la carte menu. Plenty of eating.
Back at the Morningstar pub, Seamus O'Hara is happy that both locals and tourists are pouring back into his pub and keeping things busy. But he's also pragmatic about the nature of the Irish.
Thank God it's over. And hopefully that's it. Hopefully. But they'll always gurn about something, so there's always something to protest about. So.
Small protests are continuing most Saturdays in Belfast, but the violence of December and January seems to have ebbed. It definitely feels like Belfast is focusing once again on socialising and welcoming tourists, with its character and just a bit of Guinness. Anya Coopers, DW, Belfast.
And I'm Emma Wallace in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. Now to more music in the French capital, where Notre Dame Cathedral is ringing in Easter with a set of newly minted bells to mark its 850th anniversary. The clear tones of the 10 bells now hanging from the iconic Paris landmark are reminiscent of Notre Dame's original bells, but replace the discordant jangle that has pealed out since the French Revolution. Lisa Bryant has more on the story.
Last Saturday, the heart of Paris went suddenly silent as, for the first time in more than two centuries, 9 new bells and one old one pealed out from Notre Dame Cathedral to thousands gathered to hear them on a sunny afternoon. Some, like San Francisco tourist Faith Fuller, were moved to tears.
They made me cry. This is 850 years of history of a fantastic cathedral. And I'm here in a historic moment, hearing the bells ring for the first time, so it's emotional for me and beautiful.
A children's choir sang at the bell's inauguration in a ceremony presided over by government officials and Roman Catholic clergy, who said they hoped the bells would offer a melodious counterpart to the city traffic and bustle. Notre Dame's original bells were destroyed during the French Revolution, melted down to make cannons and coins. Only one survived, 13-ton Emmanuel, and he has stayed in the lineup too. The others now hanging from the cathedral's belfries, all named after religious figures, aren't newcomers. They include a second big bell called Marie, which was cast last year in the Netherlands in the same tradition as Emmanuel.
The idea of this project of the new bell of Notre Dame was to recreate the set of bell which was as great as the one which was existing before the French Revolution. It was not to recreate an old-style set, but a 21st century set of bell.
The other eight smaller bells were cast in the Normandy foundry of bell maker Paul Bergamo. And in fact, his new set of bells sounds dramatically different from the old bells. These four 19th-century bells that have been replaced rang for coronations and for the end of the two world wars. But some bell experts joke their clangs were so ear-shattering, they rendered deaf Quasimodo, the famous fictional hunchback of Notre Dame. But replacing them has not been easy. Because of France's 1905 law separating religion and state, the bells are property of the French government, not the Catholic Church.
And that's why probably it took so long to decide to replace this bell, because it was not a priority for the state to replace this bell.
Notre Dame decided to take charge of the project, working in collaboration with the state. Bergamo's foundry began crafting the eight smaller bells in February 2012, relying on years of historic research and modern-day computer modeling.
A good bell is the bell which will ring well. As a symbolic object, it should be a bell where the decoration have a meaning.
Et la cloche va chanter. Écoutez bien.
The cathedral displayed the new bells last month before hanging them up. More than a million visitors flocked to see them, many touching their massive bronze forms that were blessed by French Cardinal André XXIII. People also gathered around as a bell expert talked about the acoustics. The bells must also be in tune with the main original bell, Emmanuel, which sets the musical foundation. Together, bellmaker Bergamo says, they are much more than the sum of their parts.
I think the people just rediscovered that when you do a project of bell, it's like evangelization, because it's a project where you federate people. It's not only a project of bell, it's a human project. And I think the people, believer or not, need this kind of project just to go ahead, to progress.
Listening to the bells now ringing out, Parisian Patrice Biraud agrees that the new bells bring people together.
Definitely, I think the role of the bell is to gather people at one point. In some period of history, there was a warning system, but I think it's a reminder that we have to be at one point in time, at the same place, and maybe it's a... as in French, prise de conscience, so it's becoming aware that something is happening, and let's find out what is happening.
Lisa Bryant, DW, Paris.
And to Germany now, where, staying in tune with our religious theme, the Protestant Church also likes to celebrate with music. In fact, it was Martin Luther, the father of Protestantism, who is credited with bringing music into the churches. And it was he, for example, who started the tradition of congregational singing. As John Lawrenson discovered during his recent travels, the Reformation produced some of the greatest music the world has ever known.
When the music is very, say, quiet and it sounds very harmonically nice, it really touches me sometimes. It's how I came to become a religious person. I only was baptized when I was in the choir already for 5 years. I have learned to love that side.
Oscar Ditt, a 17-year-old chorister, speaking after a rehearsal of Leipzig's Tamana Choir. They'll be performing in some of the concerts galore that will be put on during the Protestant Jubilee, because the link between Protestantism and music is much deeper than many realise, even in Germany. His choir is incredibly ancient, 800 years old, but it attained its greatest glory under Johann Sebastian Bach, who was director of music at the city's St. Thomas's Church for the last 27 years of his life. And he was Thomaner choirmaster. The man who now holds that post is Georg Christoph Biller.
Also er war sich seiner Begabung total bewusst, aber wusste,
God was very important for Bach. I think he was aware of his big and great talent, and he was also aware that God had given him this talent and that he should use and develop it. He signed his pieces with Solo Deo Gloria, which means God alone glory, which means that it isn't his work that is done, but God's.
A performance in the Thomaskirche of Bach's Christmas Oratorio. Bach composed hundreds of works in Leipzig. Much of his music is complex, bright, aerial, angelic. But good Protestant that he was, Bach also liked hymns, both sturdy and sublime. In this work, for example, he interwove a number of hymns, some of them by Martin Luther himself. Because Luther, the first Protestant, sang, was an accomplished lute player and a hymn writer. Martin Troy is head of the Martin Luther Museum, which is in the house where Luther used to live, in the small university town of Wittenberg, which is on the road from Leipzig to Berlin.
He was not so much a visual type, but somebody who took things through his ears. He heard things when he wrote them. This explains also why his Bible translation, for instance, is made for reading aloud. He was always praising music. He even tried his hand as a composer. There's a small motet with the different voices, but he never apparently finished this. And it's quite possible that he wrote some of the melodies for his hymns, and at least we know that he made the texts.
And some of them are famous and still sung today?
Some of them, like Mighty Fortress is Our God, are still sung today.
Ein feste Burg ist unser Gott, ein guter Wehr und Waffen.
I'm cutting meat for a winter soup.
Which you've just brought in from the balcony, because it's snowing out there.
It's snowing. The balcony is the fridge of the winter.
In Berlin, I meet up with an old friend, Wolfgang Gorgsdorf, artist, musician, and conductor of the Berlin Improvisers Orchestra. Music, he says, played a huge part in his Protestant upbringing.
Music was very important for me. We sang always when we at home. And it continued in church events, of course. Mm-hmm. We got the freedom to play the music we wanted to play. We could go up to the organ and play whatever we wanted to, but there were services, and we had the possibility of performing in these services and sang songs of all kinds. But I loved certain songs in the services. I realized at that time that music and lyrics can really address your heart.
Wolfgang is a lapsed Protestant, but Protestant music has stayed with him. Luther said, next to the word of God, the noble art of music is the greatest treasure in the world. It controls our hearts, minds, and spirits. A person who does not regard music as a marvelous creation of God does not deserve to be called a human being. He should be permitted to hear nothing but the braying of asses and the grunting of hogs. For 500 years, Germans have had in their heads the music that sprang from the tradition he started. It's one of the things that have made them what they are. John Lawrenson, DW, Wittenberg.
I could listen to that for hours too. Thanks for joining us this week. I hope you enjoyed the programme, because it was produced as always with help from Helen Sini and our sound engineer Gat Georgi. For now though, it's time to say goodbye from me, Emma Wallace. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.